Hello, hello, this is Ruben. If you really like to hear my voice and want to hear more of it, you can tune in to my two other podcasts, a spoiler podcast, which is a media criticism podcast. Our last episode focuses on Culture Shock, which is a horror film, and my other show, Chismology Anthology, which is an interview podcast. November's episode will be interviews with Caleb Luna, a queer writer whose work focuses on fat phobia and care, as well as Alan Pelaez, who is an Afro-Zapotec writer and activist whose work centers the lives of Black, Indigenous, and undocumented people. So yeah, feel free to tune into those. The link will be in the description of this episode, or you can just type them up in the search bar of wherever you're listening to this. All right, let's start the show. Just kidding, we have the Patreon shout out. All right, this show would not exist without our patrons, just like straight up. So if you want to support this podcast and want to see it continue, feel free to support the labor that goes into this, as well as all the other costs that go into making this happen. So you can support us over on patreon.com/bitterbrownfems. There will also be a link in the description. But we do want to give a big shout out to our I Know Her level supporters over on Patreon. And those would be Jen A, Danielle V, Adri, Joelle M, Cassandra G, Justine, Linda M, Saul Alexander Z, Evelyn, Abigail D, Aranya, and Kimberly B. So if you want to support us, feel free to do so over on patreon.com/bitterbrownfems. Again, the link will be in the description. All right, let's start the show for real now.
We'll do it live. I'll write it and we'll do it live. Fucking thing sucks.
5, 4, 3.
Hi, and welcome back to another.
Really bad.
That's not how we start this. What?
I said I smell really bad.
Oh, that sounds like a you problem.
Sorry.
Fuck, right when I started. You can't take Sage so seriously. Fuck. Hi, welcome back to Bitter Brown Fams. This is Ruben.
And this is Cassandra.
And we are the podcast about a lot of things. And today we are excited and sad because My Chemical Romance, you know, got back together. But we are poor.
Yes. Yeah. That's it.
Yeah, that's it. That's a podcast. Book us at bitterbrownfemspodcast.com/bookings. Follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, bitterbrownfems. What else? Support our Patreon, patreon.com/bitterbrownfems. Yeah, that's about it. Thank you for joining us.
See you next time.
Bye.
Okay, just kidding. But no, really. Everyone, okay, so we're going to talk about this in depth. But before we do all that, before we delve into like our My Chemical Romance rant special for today, how are you, Ruben?
I'm all right. How are you? I'm just stressing. I'm applying to grad school. I am, you know, counting pennies. I am eating churros, and yeah, that's where I'm at right now, and creating content.
We're, like, so stereotypical, like, Chicano exes. It's so sad. So, me and Ruben are Skyping, and then I like, pick up a concha that I was eating, and at the same time, Ruben's eating, like, a churro, and it was just, like, mm-hmm. This Aztlan moment.
What a fucking, like, what fucking chipsters, like, Skyping, and...
That was not planned, but...
And you're having, like, a pumpkin spice latte...
Wow.
But to be fair to me, I'm like serving the full fantasy because it's this cafe de olla, so
see, okay, this is the ultimate Mexican podcast. We got the birds, we got the moms yelling, the conchas, the churros, we got all that, the bad connection, you know.
What does your podcast have, huh? A nice logo?
Yeah, aside from like money
and resources and wide distribution.
Yeah.
Hmm.
But yeah, Well, I was just chilling, enjoying my day with my coffee and my concha. But yeah, no, I've just been looking for a job still, which is really hard. The economy is hard, y'all. No one wants to fucking hire me. I don't know why. That'd be my shitty resume. I don't know. But anyway, that's all I've been doing. I've been, I don't know, just taking some time to myself, which has been really, really good, actually. Like, kind of just, I don't know if y'all noticed, but, Chicanese mom's not a thing. It's not active right now. That is intentional. I didn't get, banned or anything like that. But, yeah, I've just been taking, I don't know, just much needed time for myself and focusing on my life and not dealing with, like, trolls or, you know, exhausting comments online, and that feels really good.
Yeah, I don't think folks realize, like, how much fucking work it is to have some of these things, like, to have public platforms. I think that something I've been talking to particularly Alan Palaez and Daniel Varenga about, who also have platforms, is about how, like, people think that because they follow you that they own you, and that you have to do every single little thing they ask, and that if you don't talk about a certain issue, like, you don't care, and that, you know, and for me, it's just kind of like, I've also kind of taken, I haven't deleted shit, but I have taken a step back, like, in October, like, I maybe blogged, like, 7 times. And I, you know, I didn't put out a video. I was just, like, exhausted with, like, not only my personal life, but also, like, in October, like, I dealt with, like, a lot of targeted harassment, particularly from, like, Chicanexes and folks who just, like, are very attached to, you know, this, you know, culturally appropriative identity that a lot of Chicanexes fall into when they first, you know, find Chicanismo, as we've talked about a lot. But, like, I just had to deal with it for, like, a month. Like, you've had to deal with it, like, for years now. Like, not that this hasn't happened to me before, but it hasn't been this bad. And until now. And for you, like, you've, you know, I joked with you earlier about how you're, like, the godmother of, like, you know, one of Latinx, Chicanx blogs. And, like, you've had to, you know, I can't imagine the amount of stresses that's put on you for years.
Yeah, it has, and I feel like, yeah, a lot of people don't, you know, they, you know, people, like, that like to talk shit, they'll be like, oh, you're just a meme page, or, like, you know, they'll talk down on your work, and, like, what do you, you know, they do see it as, like, you go online and you post this meme, or this article, or whatever, and, like, yeah, there are some pages that's what they do, right? but I think, like, a lot of people don't understand, like, you know, for me, the way that I do it is very intentional. Like, I don't, when I post something, it's because, like, I've really tried to process it, and, like, I know that I'm going to get backlash for it, or sometimes, like, I don't expect certain backlash from certain posts, and then I get it. It's just a lot of things. I mean, and this is, like, the very last post, I think, that I made before I deactivated recently was about Gina Rodriguez, and, like, that was only on Facebook, and it was right before we recorded our last episode, and that was, like, a lot of comments that I was getting. So I was like, I'm not even going to post this on Instagram, because I, like, a lot of people just, they really do think, yeah, that they own you, or, like, that because they're, you know, you are a public blog or platform, then you have to, like, put up with their shit, and that if you block them, like, you're petty, or, like, that's what they say, like, you just want everyone to agree with you. And it's like, no, you're just like, I'm not up for harassment. Like, this isn't like something that we can kind of like have a discussion on. It's like a yes or no thing. Yeah, I don't know. It's really exhausting. A lot of people don't realize that. And especially, like, I know, like, with you, like, when it's like a targeted harassment, it's even worse, because you're supposed to deal with, like, all these, like, endless comments and, like, defend yourself. And if you don't defend yourself, then, you know, it's just, like, a lot of things that I don't think a lot of people realize. And, like, yeah, sometimes people don't mean to put this labor on you. And then even when they're trying to, you know, not come from a bad place, like, a lot of people still demand labor from us, like, in the DMs or emails, or, like, what do you think about this? And let me send you this triggering article. And again, like, sometimes people don't do it to be, like, malice, you know, but it's still, like, a lot to expect someone to kind of be, like, this, you know, come I need you to come speak on this right away. And, you know, it's never been, like, about money, because, like, that's not, like, a thing, like, obviously. But I'm also, like, you know, I would, like, I think we need to think about people's work and, like, the labor that they do. And, like, yes, not everything needs to be compensated, but it's, like, I'm doing this shit for free out of, I'm taking, like, the time out of my day. Like, I'm not just, like, online every single day. Like, I don't have anything to do, right? So, anyway, I mean, yeah, it's, like, all of that. And then for me, like, that I don't, obviously don't share a lot because it's, like, my personal life. But, like, this last year and a half has been so, like, stressful for me. So, like, on top of all of that, you know what I mean? Like, going through depression or, you know, my grandmother dying or, like, you know, a lot of things that I'm not really gonna, like, rant about here. But, yeah, a lot of people don't see that, right? They're not gonna, they don't think, like, oh, you know, Chicanisma, or, you know, whatever you call me, like, Cassandra. Like, I'm not really thinking of her as, like, this person who has, like, all these things going on in her life. Like, yeah. I just see her as this person that puts out labor for me. Yeah. So.
Yeah. For me, like you said, it's not about compensation. Like, what I think I want from folks is consideration. Like, consideration of the fact that, like, I'm putting myself out there. Like, I, you know, if I made a video, like, the video took, like, a week to make. If, you know, if a podcast goes out there, it took days to make, you know, a blog post. Like, it's not just, like, me out my ass. It was, like, me constructing this thing. Like, a meme as well. Like, all these things, like, take work. And, like, social media moderation, that's also, like, literally, there's a position called social media manager that brands pay people upwards of $60,000 to do every fucking year. Like, that is literally, in and of itself, a job. And it is recognized as a job. And then here we are, like, doing it for fucking free. Like, so all these things, like, add up. Like, and so I think what I need from folks is consideration, like, engaging in good faith, because yeah, like, in the last month, like, I even had to change my number recently, just because shit got bad. So it is what it is. Like, I mean, it's not, it, no, I'm not gonna say that it isn't, it is, but it shouldn't be. It's what's up. Like, people need to, I don't know, learn to see other people online as human.
Yeah, which is, like, very a very basic, like, concept, but it does, I feel like it does get lost online, you know? And, yeah, I'm glad that you pointed out, like, you know, I've been talking about, like, looking for a job, and I always see, like, social media managers, and I'm always, like, I don't even feel comfortable, like, applying to those jobs, because I know that it means, like, I wouldn't be able to be, like, oh, I have this, like, political, like, this political, like, page and platform that people are going to take, people, like, in that, like, career world are going to take seriously, which is fucked up, right? Because I've done that work for, like, 4 years and have built, like, my own platform, but it's still not something that's going to be taken into, like, a serious position with, like, actual companies. So, yeah, it's kind of, like, fucked up. But, yeah, consideration. I mean, there are people who follow me who have, like, you know, been like, here's $5, you know, and my Venmo, and I appreciate those people so much, because, again, it's not about being paid, but it makes me feel like, oh, you know, like, these people are, they probably don't have a lot either, right? A lot of us don't, but they appreciate, like, or they see the work that I'm trying to do, and if they don't have money, like, there's DMs that I get that are, like, you know, like, appreciative, and that makes me feel good. But yeah, I think a lot of people just need to take a step back and be like, oh, these are, and, like, again, I think people that listen to this podcast, I think, see our humanity a little more, because I can tell, like, the people follow me on Chicanisma that listen to Bitter Brown Femmes, and then the people that just see me as, like, this platform and, like, don't even know what the fuck I look like, apparently. And so, yeah, I don't know. If you really like somebody's work and you follow them and you learn from them, just, like, take those people and see their whole humanity and maybe reflect on that before you send them, like, certain articles or demand some labor from them or expect it from them. Or that if they don't reply or they don't do it or they don't share this post, it's not because they hate you or because they're being petty or something like that. It's just, like, a lot of us, you know, we have a lot going on. And it's not because we're trying to be, you know, rude or we don't care what you're saying, but it's just like, this isn't, I don't know. It's not like our only job or the only thing that we have going on.
Yeah. I think you're correct on like how like people who usually listen to the podcast, like usually have a fuller picture of us. And we get the most beautiful messages from folks. And it's always really reassuring. Recently, I was talking to my friend Alan, who actually went on a date with queer person, and they were like, "Do you listen to podcasts? I love podcasts. My favorite is Bitter Brown Femmes, and they really helped me through grad school, and like they made me feel like not alone, like when I was like in the middle of a primarily white institution." And then recently, after our last two episodes, we've been getting a lot of like affirmations about our voices and things like that. I think one of the most beautiful one was from Maimuna, who is a queer Muslim person who's originally from South Africa, but then they had to move to New Zealand because of their family, and they developed like a New Zealand accent. So when they go visit their family in Africa, their family kind of makes fun of the fact that they lost like their, you know, their African accent. And so they connected to us in that way. And I was like so overwhelmed with the fact that like we are, like, this is not something that I ever imagined. Like, yeah, I'm going to connect with, like, you know, a queer black person in South Africa is going to, like, connect with the way my voice sounds. And, like, it was just, ridiculously affirming and just one of those magical things that happens on the internet. Yeah.
Yes. So thank you to everyone who's ever sent us anything, even if it's just like, I really enjoyed this episode, or any feedback, because it does, you know, sometimes I feel like, you know, in particular, maybe not with Bitter Brown Femmes, but with Chicanisma, for example, like, there's been a lot of times, especially recently, that I'm like, what am I doing? Like, is it worth, like, all my emotional labor? Like, am I even making a difference? Or like, what is this, you know? So like, and not just for me, I'm sure for a lot of, like, creators out there, like, meeting people or just, like, emailing or telling us, like, I appreciate you, you helped me learn, you helped me grow, or whatever the case may be, like, it really is reaffirming. So, thank you for that.
Yeah, and so, now we're going to talk about somebody that we don't want to affirm.
Who? Which one?
Beto, on the Beto O'Rourke. Let's start with Betito Robert del Rancho O'Rourke. Betito del Rancho. Betito Mercedes. Betito del Barrio.
Okay.
Betito de Duranguito.
No, absolutely not. You better stop.
So Beto O'Rourke, Robert O'Rourke, finally decided to drop from the presidential race after spending countless of your fucking donation dollars and, you know, speaking as like bocho ass Spanglish in the national stage, literally running on like nothing but like white boy, like gusto and like, you know, overconfidence. Like, Beto O'Rourke literally failed up, like, into this presidential race. Like, he has literally, like, not shown shit that he can somehow manage, like, to run a country. He's, like, every, like, little white boy who gets, like, a management position because the upper management really believes in his potential, while a person of color who has, like, worked there for years, like, does not get, like, any fucking shine. And yes, I'm talking about Julian Castro.
Yes, exact. So, Robert Francis dropped out of the race.
His middle name is
our El Paso hero. Yeah, his middle name is Francis.
See, now he can't get married.
Robert Francis O'Rourke. Yeah. The thing is, I mean, among this, like, a lot of things that obviously have problems with him, is that a lot of people have called on him, I don't know if I've mentioned this before, one of our episodes, to drop out of the presidential race and run for Senate. And I think, despite what I feel about him, like, I wish he would just, you know, kind of go away. I don't understand why that's, if he really, you know, he's like, I care about this country, I care about whoever the fuck he says he cares about, Texas or El Paso or whoever, And it's like, why won't you run for Senate then? Because obviously you have a better chance of winning the Senate, right? Then you do the presidential race. And if you really wanted to make a difference or what you're passionate about, like, then you would do that. And so that's why it's like another reason I don't believe anything of what he says. And yeah, it's like these people that are running, like, at the end of the day, they're going to keep all those donations. And even if they don't win president, even if they don't win, like, they're still rich. Like, O'Rourke fundraised when he was running against Ted Cruz, and then right after that, he jumped into the presidential race, and he raised so much money on top of already being fucking rich, right? And it's like, okay, now he's out, and he's still, like, okay, he's still a millionaire with everybody's donation, so doesn't seem like he actually lost anything to me. But I mean, I'm sick of talking about him. It's weird because obviously he lives here in El Paso, but I've never run into him. I know where he lives. I drive by his house sometimes, not like in a creepy way. It's just there. Anyway, yes, but Julian Castro, it's been very interesting, like, especially, like, in Texas, and, like, local news, but also, like, Texas publications that are, they're always kind of, like, the two Texas candidates, right? One is O'Rourke and one is Julian Castro, and it's kind of always giving more spotlight to O'Rourke, and it's this weird thing, because, like, O'Rourke has positioned himself not just in this presidential race, but, like, even before, as, you know, people are like, oh, he's, like, the token white Latino. I don't even know if that, like, makes sense, but you know what I mean? Like, they're, like, Beto, and, like, if he's fucking Latino, which he is not, obviously, but, like, he's, like, a honorary, like, Latino because he says Spanish words sometimes, and because he goes by Beto, and he's from El Paso, and then there's, like, an actual fucking brown man from San Antonio. Not a border city, but still another Texas city, another Texas city that has a high population of, like, Latinx folks. And it's still, like, and who has, like, I would say better ideas or a better campaign than O'Rourke, and, like, not really get spotlight or even kind of have to, like, fight his way into, like, the debate stage. So that is very interesting to talk about, and it's kind of, I know, like, been trying to find a way to talk about it without making it this, like, a leeway for, you know, certain Latinx folks, primarily Chicanx folks, to use it as a way to center themselves, as always. But there is something to be said about the way that Julian Castro hasn't really gotten a lot of media attention, right? Compared to all the other candidates. And it's like, I mean, let's be real. He's, like, the only Latino running. So why is that?
He's the only Latino in, like, I think most of my, like, adult memory that, like, mm-hmm. has made it this far. And that's funny, is because they always, like, want, like, a Latino proxy, right? During Hillary Clinton's time, who was her vice president? Like, that dude who, like, spoke Spanish and, like, did a missionary, like, mission in, like, Central America at some point.
Like, oh, yeah, but he was white. Yeah, I forgot. Tim, I don't know something, his name.
I feel like. But, like, they were, you know, he was, like, he would always, he was, like, Beto, like, he was, like, the prototype for Beto O'Rourke in some ways, because he would also bring up the Spanish in random parts, random shits, and
instead of getting, like, an actual Latinx candidate. Yeah.
It's like mainstream politicians understand that, like, Latinxes are, like, this growing population that now make up anywhere between 12-17% of the voting of a voting public, but they don't know exactly how to reach them without alienating, like, their racist white, like, followers. So they, like, get, like, a Latinx proxy, right? And so, and we've seen, like, the racism jump out, specifically with Julian Castro, right? Like, we got shit, like, you know, when he, like, called out the inconsistencies of Joe Biden's support of, like, Medicare and, like, whatever structure he has, like, people were like, oh, Julian Castro crossed the line by being mean to Joe Biden. Joe Biden's such a fragile old man. He needs us to protect him. Julian Castro's a bad, bad brown man. Like, it was like, that was like the most attention that Julian Castro really got.
Mm-hmm. That or just like them always confusing him with his twin brother.
Yep. And like, this isn't even an endorsement of Julian Castro. Like, I'm not going to pretend that I don't like agree with some stuff that he has said, and that I don't think that like he hasn't presented like a more progressive of stance than a lot of other folks have. But at the end of the day, like, he is a fucking liberal, and like, you know, as always, like, we have to put their feet to the fire. But at the same time, like, calling out like how, you know, the mainstream politics function in a way that erases Latinx's and, you know, and other people of color. Because, like, you know, sure, we have Kamala Harris and, like, Cory Booker and, like, Andrew Yang on a national stage. And at one point, even that, you know, other folks. But, like, they are, like, you know, one in a million, right? Like, at the end of the day, like, the Senate, like, you know, everything, the House, like, the whole fucking White House, the way that's set up, it's still white as fuck. So it's still, like, yes, they're ignoring Latinxes, and they're also ignoring, like, other people of color. I think that, for me, the case of Julian Castro is just interesting, considering, you know, Beto, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think if you've listened to this podcast or, like, followed me and Ruben, like, you know how we feel about electoral politics and about liberals. And the whole everything, right? And so definitely Julian Castro is a liberal. He's not perfect. Like, but he really did surprise me. Like, I think when I was like, okay, like, he's running. Like, I was kind of, I don't live in San Antonio, but I've been familiar with him and his brother's, like, politics. Not politics necessarily, but, like, with them as, you know, politicians. And so when he was running, I was like, oh, this is, like all the, like, Latinx media, this is, like, the person that they're going to push for, right? Like, this is the person that they're going to stand by and the person that everyone's going to defend, like, no matter what. And I feel like even, I'm not sure, but I feel like even with Latinx media, I don't feel like they've given him that much attention either. And this, it's kind of weird. I could be wrong on that. That's just from what I've seen or haven't seen. But he did take me by surprise with, like, I mean, obviously he's not perfect, but I was kind of like, oh, okay, he's not as bad as I thought he was. Obviously, he's still liberal, but it did take, like, I was kind of like, oh, okay, he's not, like, that horrible as I, like, imagined he would be. And I think that we can still talk about, like, yeah, he's a liberal, yes, electoral politics, but also acknowledge that, you know, like, these nuances in the way that he's being treated. And it kind of reminds me, actually, of, like, Alexandria Cortez also, because, like, I have a lot of feelings about her politics, right? And then I know we've talked about her and her stances on things and, you know, critiques of her. And at the same time, I always get very fucking upset that she is, like, the fucking person that all the, like, Republicans and conservatives hate, like, so much, as a, like, acknowledging that she's, like, a Latina, the youngest, like, a woman, a Latina, that she's, like, the youngest person in Congress, and, like, she is, like, the face, like, she is, like, the person that they all, like, lash out at, and it pisses me the fuck off, because I know it's racist, and I know it's, like, sexist as fuck, and all of these things, and then I can still hold, like, my own critiques of her on top of that as well, and, like, those things exist for me, and I feel that way also about, like, Castro, so.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I think, I mean, I even made a video about this particular point, about, like, how, you know, neoliberalism functions in such a way that makes like these political figures into, like, untouchable idols, and that, like, how that's a trap that we shouldn't fall for. And I think the funny thing about with Beto is that, like, a lot of, like, Latinx folks were falling into that trap, even though, like, Beto wasn't even Latinx, like,
like, but he did position himself in that way. And then,
but, like, you know, he had such a strong Latinx following. It was ridiculous. Like, whenever I would, like, critique him on Twitter, like, it would be Latinxes who would come defend him. And I'm like, girl, what are you doing? Like, what? I am so...
Yeah, like, that one time... when was it? It was, like, during that debate where he like spoke Spanish, and then I think we had talked about this, about, I don't know if it was you that tweeted or someone, you know, people were, we were talking about like Spanglish or like not knowing Spanish or something, and then like obviously we were talking about him as a white man, but then like everyone in the comments was like Latinx folks who didn't know how to speak Spanish, but somehow they like felt personally attacked. And I'm like, what are you doing? Like, why are you like putting yourself in the same category as this white man who's not even fucking Latino? Like, like, why are you going so hard for this guy?
And like and like, okay, I know this is like a jump, a bit of a jump, but to me, or maybe to some people it's not a jump, but to me it's interesting how a lot of Latinxes see themselves more in white people than they do with other Latinxes. And to to me, that's like, I forgot who I was talking to or what I was watching, but it was this like report on like how Latinxes don't really fit into like America's like racial categorization, and a fear of how like, you know, Italian folks and Armenian folks also didn't fit into whiteness initially, but because of white supremacy, like, it always wants to make more white people, like, they, like, you know, took Italian folks and Armenian folks and other ethnic folks who were not considered white, like, into their fold, right, and afforded them whiteness. And so part of me is, like, feeling this, like, tension of, like, damn, a lot of Latinxes see themselves in white people a lot. Like, is this, like, the first step or, like, whatever step we're on of, like, us being folded into whiteness? And, like, that's really scary to me. Like, I don't know if that made any sense.
It made perfect sense, and I don't think it's a jump at all. I think it's a lot of things, right, that we obviously always discuss about Latinidad. It's not a race. It's a lot of nationalities. And it's, like, a lot. A lot to unpack, and some of, you know, some Latinxes are already white, so they're already afforded that. But a lot of like Latinx that aren't white, who are brown or light skin, not black either, like do identify more with whiteness, and it's very interesting. I think about like me when I was younger, and for example, I used to like love playing with Barbies. And I started thinking about what kind of Barbies I had. And they were usually white. There was like some brown ones. But I had no black Barbies at all. They were mostly white or like sometimes brown. And when I think about it now that I'm older, like, it's weird. Because I'm like, obviously I'm not saying that I'm black or that I would obviously identify as black. But I feel like I would have more of a connection to seeing a black doll or like a darker skin doll or a brown doll than I would a white, blonde, blue-eyed doll. But those were the dolls that I had, and I never, obviously as a kid, never really thought about that. Like, I just saw them, how we see whiteness as the standard, right? Like, they're like the norm. And then, I don't know, it's like, yeah, I don't know, it is very interesting that, and it's, I don't know, it's also that thing of like wanting to assimilate and wanting to be white and wanting to be accepted. And so like, you just, like, a lot of people identify more with like colonizers. Like, there's people on Twitter that are like all about like the Spanish, like identifying solely as Spanish because they see that as like a power thing and like this good thing.
Oh, girl, yeah, Demi Lovato, when somebody was like, oh, you're Latina, right? And she was like, no, I took a DNA test and I'm actually Spaniard. And I'm like, okay, girl.
No, she said that?
Yeah, that she was on a whole trip that during that era, because that was also during the time she was like, I'm 1% African or something like that.
Oh, God. She's a hot mess. A hot, hot mess. I didn't even get started on Demi Lovato's whack ass, but I just, after the whole Israel-Palestine
thing, I forgot about that. I'm oh, like, girl, you know, she's so hard to root for.
She is a hot mess. But anyway, no, that's not a jump. And yeah, it is scary to think about that.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I feel like, yeah. Like, yeah. Okay. Very, very,
I was like looking around my room to see if I have any white women, and it's like, okay, all the Golden Girls. I have a lot of Golden Girls paraphernalia. But I am an old white woman. Fuck, this is how they get us. We're like here, like, They're like, we relate to, like, relating to whiteness is how we get folded into whiteness in America. Welcome to our MCR episode. our incongruencies. Yes.
So, anyway, enough about that. Let's dive into My Chemical Romance. So, let's see. A lot of people, so, okay, when did this happen? Last week? Yeah, right? So, last week, My Chemical Romance announced a show in LA for next month, for December. It's already sold out. obviously, it's already sold out. But everyone is excited because that means they're playing a show together. And hopefully, an actual tour, a full tour next year, maybe an album. I don't know. But it's been really exciting. And of course, a lot of y'all tagged us in like all of these things, like on Bitter Brown Femmes, because you know that we love My Chemical Romance. We love Gerard Way. And so, yeah, I was really happy, but I was also very sad because like I'm not going to see them. And even like, because I don't live nearby. So even if I, you know, somehow had money to buy a ticket, I would still have to figure out how to get there, and there's a lot of logistics, and not only that, but, like, actually getting the tickets, right? Because it's not, like, just because you have money, you're gonna get the tickets. So the whole thing is really sad, because we really want to go, but we can't. But we're also, I don't know, just hoping that we might, hopefully, get to see them next year.
Yeah. If they tour. Yeah, no, they're playing, like...
I have a feeling that they will. But yeah. I'm not trying to get my hopes up, but I feel like they are, though.
Yeah. You know, the place where they're playing is, like, fairly near my house, like a 20-minute drive. But the venue they picked is so small. Like, no shade to MIA and Hot Chip, who are two bands that I saw, who I've seen at that place. But, like, they do not have the mass following that My Chemical Romance does. Like, that place is for, like, you know, big indie bands, not for like a mainstream, like, genre defining band. Like, so that was weird that they chose that venue.
Well, intentional. I think it's intentional, and they want, like, which is also interesting because, like, I want to say they want, like, this buildup of, like, people being like, oh, damn, I didn't see it. But I feel like that would happen anyway because they're My fucking Chemical Romance. Like, they don't need to do all that. But they're also very, like, dramatic and, like, extra in that way. So, I mean, so if you were one of the lucky people that is going to get to see them, I hope you die. Congrats. Congrats to you. All bitter. Congrats to you.
Congrats to you. I hope you have a wonderful time.
Have a wonderful time.
And you don't get injured when you're in the pit.
No, but so we actually wanted to talk a little bit about My Chemical Romance. Kind of as a, you know, like we've mentioned, we do talk about a lot of political things and heavy things, and sometimes we just want to talk about My Chemical Romance or have like a special episode about just our love for My Chemical Romance and kind of like delve into that in a political but also like a lighthearted way.
And this is a good time to talk about 9/11 too.
Yeah, so it's just like a lot happening. Everyone's like, 9/11, what the fuck can we talk about
9/11? No, okay, so like, rewind. So me and my friends, my closest friends are a bunch of Chicanx emos. And we you know, we met in college and we all just like randomly found out that we were all My Chem stans. And, you know, there's even a picture of us all in the same My Chemical Romance t-shirt. And something that we, like, came to talking to is, like, why was our generation so gravitated towards emo, right? And I think a big part of it was that, like, we were, like, one of the first generations that was, like, impacted by the attacks on the Twin Towers and then the consequent, like, hyper-nationalism that existed, like, right immediately after. And so... not only were we consistently subjected to that violence because they would play the attack on repeat in our television, even I think on Nickelodeon. I swear to God that they would play the events that happened And so we were subjected to that trauma, but we were also subjected to, like, you know, all the adults around us suddenly waving, like, huge American flags and, like, knowing that, like, both of these things were, like, bizarre and wrong, right? Like, obviously violence is wrong and terrorism is wrong, but then also, like, this, like, unquestioning nationalism that overtook America was also wrong. And so we were, like, completely disillusioned both with, like, the project of America and, like, the state of the world, right? And I think that we didn't have the words to articulate that political mind frame, right? But what we did have was, like, a lot of feelings, and that's something that emo really, you know, like, capitalized on, right? That it really, it was good at. It was good at just, like, unadulterated, like, unbridled, like, emotion, like, anger, sadness, and, like, every song was just about a feeling, and there was feelings from, like, a quote-unquote high school or middle school perspective, right? Like, even though the bands were usually, like, not in high school or, you know, or middle school, they spoke to that audience. Like, a lot of the stuff was, like, oh, my first kiss or something, or, like, you know, high school sucks. Like, even, you know, My Chemical Romance first big video, like, I'm Not Okay, like, was about them at, like, a prep school, right? Like, and they positioned themselves at these as these outsiders. Well, I am saying, like, emo, kind of one of the factors of why it became so big and then why it couldn't function for other generations is that we were a generation of trauma in a way that generations before us were not in the U.S.
Definitely. And emo didn't start, you know, like, in 2001. I think that's, like, the fourth wave of emo happened. They're, like, emo existed before that. But, like, the way the fourth wave bands, which is, like, you know, My Chemical Romance, like, Fall Out Boy, Panic at the Disco, like, those types of, like, those mainstream bands that made it mainstream, it was, like, it was mainstream. That's what it was. Because, you know, before that time, like, when I would listen to emo wasn't, like, this cool thing. I remember, like, listening to punk and listening to emo and, like, being very ashamed of even liking emo, and it was, like, the punks would kind of be like, you like emo, get the fuck out of here. And it was not this cool thing to do. Like, I had to listen to Dashboard, like, secretly, until I felt like emo all of a sudden just, like, was everywhere and everyone fucking loved it. And it was it was like I said, like, the fourth wave emo bands that, like, those, I think those were, like, the top three, like, you know, main bands that people, like, can reference, right? But after that, it was, like, the wave. Like, emo was, like, everywhere, and it was cool, and everyone was into it or whatever. But I had never really thought about the 9/11 connection until we said we were going to talk about this, and then I know you had said, like, oh, you know, we can talk about 9/11, and then I thought, oh, like, you listen, and then I told you, oh, you know, that's how My Chemical Romance actually became a band. And so, like, it was, like, mind blown. Because Gerard Way, there's actually a couple interviews that y'all can look up where he talks about him on his way to work when he was in New York when 9/11 happened, and him talking about what that experience was like, and him feeling, like, also, like, a state of what am I doing with my life, and feeling despair, and feeling like his job wasn't what he wanted to be doing. And really, that's how he started, like, My Chemical Romance, right? Like, he wanted to put kind of, like, all of that into the world for people to connect to. And so it's really interesting that Ruben had brought up the 9/11 thing, and then I was like, hey, like, when I had seen that interview of Gerard Way talking about, like, 9/11, and technically that's how, like, how My Chemical Romance kind of, like, started, I thought it was, like, it wasn't funny. I didn't, because there's, like, a couple interviews. There's one where, like, he really, like, talks about it very seriously, and, like, you kind of understand where he's coming from. But I think the first, like, little interview that I saw, he said it very, like, nonchalantly, I didn't really understand the connection, like, why did 9/11 make you want to start My Chemical Romance? And so, like, I thought it was kind of funny, and I was like, okay, like, I guess I have to thank George Bush for My Chemical Romance. But anyway, I just thought that was really interesting. But then now that we're kind of talking about, because I feel like a lot of people don't talk about 9/11 or really think about 9/11 in this way, at least for millennials. Like, after 9/11, I think it really did just change our whole generation if we, even if we didn't feel it in that moment. But when I look back on it, like, that happened, I was in seventh grade when 9/11 happened. And right after 9/11 happened, I remember one of my best friends, her brother and her family, they used to, like, say that I was Osama bin Laden's daughter. And what? Make, like, very... Yeah, they used to make, like, these, like... Because I, like, you know, compared to her, she was, like, a white Latina. I was, like, brown. And they would... they would make, like, these jokes about me being dark and me being brown. And I guess kind of... I don't feel like I look Muslim or anything like that. But that's what they would kind of, like, imply and make jokes about. And at the time, like, I wasn't, like, oh, this is racist. Like, I thought it was annoying, but I didn't really... You know, I was like, okay, haha, whatever. But, like, now when I look back on it, I'm like... And this is, like, I've had, like, conversations with people who have said the same thing to me, right? Like, for example, like, with Jose, he's also told me that after 9/11, people would always ask him, like, where he was from. Or say he was, like, you know, like, South Asian. Or ask him what he was doing. Like... I don't know, and I think that that was a reality for a lot of brown people, and I think when we're younger, we don't really understand that until, like, we grow older. Because, like, for me, when people are always, like, talking about 9/11, I'm like, I don't really feel, like, when it happened, I didn't even really feel anything about it. When I was in seventh grade, to be honest, I really didn't, like, I knew it was fucked up, but I didn't really understand it. Like, I was like, okay, we got attacked, but, like, I don't, like, I just didn't really... I don't know, fully, like, comprehend it until I got older and the war happened and all of those things started happening. And as I got older, obviously, but looking back on it, I do feel that we are that generation, like, you know, and people always love to talk shit about millennials and blame us for literally fucking everything, especially, you know, the boomers. And it's like, they don't really even want to stop and think about, like, what the millennial generation has, like, gone through or, like, seen, or how all of this has kind of, like, affected us, even though we don't really think about it, like, how it's affected our lives. But anyway, going back to emo, I do kind of see that correlation. I think especially with My Chemical Romance. And what's interesting is that I love emo. Like, I've always listened to emo, but for me, My Chemical Romance, even though they fall into that emo, like, genre, My Chemical Romance has always been, like, this, at the same time, like, this very separate band from the rest of the emo, you know, like, the emo bands, because a lot of the emo bands are about teen angst and heartbreak and your boyfriend sucks and I'm a nice guy, why don't you date me, and I'm so sad, you know, like Hawthorne Heights and, like, The Used, like, all of these bands, like, Saves the Day, right, Dashboard. But when we look at My Chemical Romance always position themselves as, like, just, like, so much more than that. And I think that you can really see that with my black with the Black Parade, with my Black Parade,
it's mine.
You can really see that with Black Parade, because that album was just, like, it was a concept album, and it was about what, about death and loss and, like, trauma. And a lot of emo bands did not do that. You know, like, I'm saying, they were all about, like, Taking Back Sunday, Brand New. They were all about, like, heartbreak and jealousy and I'm upset and I hate my fucking hometown, right? That's, like, all pop punk is. And you had My Chemical Romance fucking doing, like, these amazing videos and, like, being so, like, theatrical about it. Like, they fucking wore, like, uniforms. They did, like, dance routines, like, in their music videos. They were just so much more than, like, all those other bands. And I always felt like My Chemical Romance sometimes wasn't even a part. Even though they were, like, really big, they still were... A lot of people didn't fuck with them because they didn't know how to, like, approach My Chemical... Yeah, like, they didn't know how to process them. Like, they were, like, maybe, like, during, like, Three Cheers, they were still, I think, more in that, you know... like, in that community or whatever. But, like, again, in, like, the Black Parade, I think they just took it to this very, this other thing that it, they set the standard of, like, what emo bands could do. Like, so much more than just, you know, like, these, like, sappy love songs or whatever. But, yeah, you didn't really see a lot of emo bands actually unpacking, like, or celebrating or talking about cancer and like death and like darkness and all of that. So I like love My Chemical Romance for that, and I love their theatrics, and I just think they're just so brilliant. And I think they've always kind of, because they approach that, I think that it did help a lot of teenagers or a lot of youth or even adults, like, kind of not be afraid to talk about that. Because even though I think when you're in high school or you're in middle school or whatever, people are like, oh, your problems aren't that serious, right? Like, you can't really have all these feelings about trauma or about death or about loss or whatever that might be. Like, we do, and we did. And maybe they're not the same as we do now. You know, now that I'm 30, I don't have the same feelings or issues that I did when I was in high school, but I still had them, and they were still valid. And I feel, for me, My Chemical Romance did validate that. And,
yeah. Yeah, I think for me, they put words, and they externalize my internal life, right? So I didn't, you know, I didn't know how to communicate, like, my angst other than, like, fuck, I'm gay in this primarily Latinx community, you know, like, you know, bullying sucks and all that shit, and, like, I hate my family, blah, blah, blah. Like, I didn't know how to articulate it beyond that, right? And they were able to express pain that was much, that wasn't mine, of course. I had never lost anyone at that point. But I did experience, like, you know, hopelessness a lot. And they really put, you know, words to that. And you're right, also, I also never felt condescended to in the way that other emo bands, maybe I saw other emo bands' lyrics, you know, were a bit condescending, maybe not on purpose, but like, to me, I was like, oh, I'm above this like high school drama shit, right? Like, I want like lyrics with meaning, but I still want them to be whiny and like theatric. And so they really did that. They were also like super like flamboyant and like, mm-hmm. and queer before I knew even that, like, you know, Gerard Way identified as like bisexual and like, you know, and gender nonconforming, and so to me it was also like it was also cathartic in that manner. I think ultimately, like, they really gave me a lot of hope when I didn't really have much, so that's why I'm very thankful to them. And I was very blessed that I got to see them open up for Linkin Park, like, when I was in high school. Mm-hmm.
That's amazing. I would love to see My Chemical Romance and Linkin Park.
And rest AFI. In
peace, Chester.
AFI open for My Chem and My Chem open for Linkin Park.
I love all of those bands. I love Davey Havoc, too. yeah, I was going to say, My Chemical Romance is totally, like, it's also such a queer band. And I think it all, like, makes sense with, like, what we're saying. Like, they're very, like, their performances, like, their aesthetic. If you watch their music videos, if you watch The Umbrella Academy, like, that is why I love The Umbrella Academy, because it's such an amazing show and comic, but also because it really is, like, My Chemical Romance, like, in a fucking comic, in a show, and it's, like, amazing. But did you ever feel, like, were you, like, because I know that there's people that, like, love My Chemical Romance, just My Chemical Romance, for example, versus, like, were you actually a part of, like, the emo punk music scene, or were you, were you just more kind of like, eh, they're okay, but, like, just really drawn to My Chemical Romance? Like, did you have, you know, I mean, did you hang out with, like, people that also were in that scene, or did you feel, like, isolated because you listened to My Chemical Romance?
I didn't feel isolated, but, like, so, I mean, it wasn't cool. Like, it wasn't cool to listen to emo. And because it wasn't cool, there wasn't a scene so much, right? So what I did end up doing is that's when MySpace used to be, like, the it thing for, like, parties and stuff. So I would go to, like, a lot of emo scene parties in my high school years. So that's where I met people who, like, looked how I wanted to look, right? And and were like the people who I wish were my friends, but I never really made friends with them because like it was just a party, right? And because all my friends growing up were like metalheads and like quote unquote like real punk, like OG punk, right? Sex Pistols, like Ramones type of punks. But I had four friends who were like really into emo. For me, like other than AFI, My Chem, and I don't know, in the periphery, even though Killers were not emo by any means, and neither were Modest Mouse, like they were like my introduction to like an alternative rock that eventually became like my favorite type of music, right? So through Killers I found Yeah Yeah Yeahs and like, you know, The Rapture and bands in that nature, right? We Are Scientists and so forth, like really alternative art punky bands. So for me, I wasn't allowed to wear black in high school. Like, I wasn't allowed to wear black or have like tight jeans or anything. So I couldn't really look how I wanted to look either. And so the parties, the emo scene parties, were the only outlet that I had for this world, right? My only like venue to this world.
I was, I was allowed, well, I mean, my mom never really told me what to wear. I wish she would have enforced them because she'd always, like, side-eye everything that I wore. And I'd be like, whatever, mom, I look super cool. And now I'm like, wow, she was right. I looked whack. But I did, I was able to be, like, that emo person and dress like that. Like, I had the mullet, you know, I had, like, the side thing. I did all of that, and I was a part of like that music scene, like the local music scene here, which we've also talked about in like the episodes about Predators in the emo scene.
I was trying to make my way to that.
So. Yeah, which is a whole conversation that we've had before. I was a part of that whole culture, you know, and that was like my high school. That's like what defined it. And so, like, now that I'm, like, 30, like, I still listen to The Used. I still listen to May. I still listen to all these bands that I've always listened to and I'm probably forever going to listen to. And I don't know what that says about me. But these are, like, it's not a phase, you know? Like, I still listen to these bands and, like, they still shaped, like, who I am. And I think for me, I was also thinking, like, what does that mean, you know, like, as a person, as a brown person, like, as a Latinx person, like, if you don't listen to cumbias or reggaeton or Selena or, like, all these things, like, then you're trying to be white or, I don't know if that's, like, I'm sure that's, like, a thing, but
well, like, absolutely.
For me, yeah, like, for me, I've always, like, I'm drawn more to, like, I listen to, like, white bands mostly, and white men particularly, and even though like I'm always like fuck white men, obviously, like I still find myself like that's a music that I like, you know. And then we have that conversation of like punk and rock and emo being like a white male's particularly dominated genre. And so for someone who's not white to listen to that music, like what does that mean, or does it even have to mean anything, right? Like, why can't we just fucking like listen to this music, which we can talk about like the actual history of rock and how it was invented by like a black woman, right? But like right now, like the way that we see emo or the way that we see punk is obviously like just white men, white bands. But I was also thinking about being emo and like being a Latinx person, and also maybe for me having, like you said, like they were able to, My Chemical Romance in particular and other bands were able to put into words what like you're feeling. And as a teenager you feel a lot of fucking things, right? Like you're going through all those hormones, you're like trying to figure out where you belong, you have bullies at school, you have enemies, you have like heartbreak, you're questioning your sexuality. Like there's a lot going on in high school, and so listening to these bands kind of help you, even if it's just to yell, you know. When I hear like Helena from like Chemical Romance or like any band, I'm just like, it makes me feel good to yell that and maybe even cry along with it. But I think in particular coming from like a Latinx household in which emotions aren't not necessarily like centered, or vulnerability is not this thing that you can, especially for me, that I can do easily with my parents, or like it's like this moment of weakness. Like I think for me that was also an outlet, which I think my parents didn't really understand, or at least not my dad, because my dad, he's actually not emo. My dad's not emo, but you know, he is like all about punk and rock and metal and plays guitar, and it wasn't weird for him. But for my mom, you know, like, she probably thought it was like the devil's music and going back to like religion, but also again coming from like a household where like, why would you, which is also interesting to say, like, why would you want to listen to music where you're like sad and like heartbroken, because I think that's a lot of Spanish music at the same time. But maybe it's like, that is acceptable to listen to that music at family parties and like be heartbroken or whatever, but it's not okay if you're like, I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, I don't think I ever went through, I don't know, for me it was never, I never felt I was whitewashed because I listened to the music, and it's, and I don't know if it's because I also, like, I never just listened to punk bands, like, and to, like, emo, like, that's never just been my, I've always been very eclectic with my music taste, like, you know, my first concert was Paulina Rubio, but also, like, I mean, I grew up in LA, like, we have one of the biggest, like, Latin American, like, populations in the United States, but also our radio, like, we have multiple stations that play different genres of Latinx music, and so I was also always gravitated to, like, rock en español and, like, you know, pop en español, so, you know, folks like Alejandra Guzman and Gloria Trevi and Paulina Rubio and Hombres G and Café Tacuba, Caifanes, like, that was also part of my upbringing. So, I think if anything, when I entered, like, college and when I was, you know, I that's when I was questioning my own taste and figuring out what it meant that, like, oh, like, my favorite bands are all, you know, mostly white, and, but I, at the end of the day, for me, it was, like, this is something I listen to, this is not something that defines me in any capacity, like, my consumption is not identity, right, and I think that's where people often, like, kind of lose themselves, they think that, like, you know, they, because I listen to, you know, Calle 13, like, I am the most revolutionary, or because I listen to Ana Tijoux and, like, you know, Mon Laferte, like, I am super decolonized, and I'm super, like, more proud of being brown, and to me, it's just, like, no, that's just your, that's your taste, like, and no shade to your taste at all, but it just isn't mine, and that doesn't really change, like, I'm not less of an abolitionist because I listen to Britney Spears, right, or, like, to My Chemical Romance, like, and, but because people fall on this trap of, like, you know, the things that I consume make me who I am, that's why we have people who, you know, live and die by the words of, like, Residente, you know, from Calle 13, but they're still misogynists, right? And, like, and so on and so forth. Or listen to rap, but are still anti-black. Like, to me, it is a part of what shapes my taste in art, but it is not ultimately what shapes my politic.
Definitely. Yeah, I don't feel that I was whitewashed either. I never, like I've mentioned a lot, I've never really thought about race at all in any capacity that much. Because again, in the, I said I was a part of the music scene here, and that music scene was also like Mexican American because I'm in El Paso. Like, it wasn't a, like, a white scene, and so, like, that was not something that I thought about, like, oh, I'm brown and I'm listening to, like, I'm emo, or like, I'm listening to punk or in white bands. Like, I never really thought about that. But like, we get, like, I remember we posted actually, like, for Gerard Way's birthday on our Instagram and, like, on Facebook, like, happy birthday, dad, because, you know, that's our dad. We've always made it known that we love My Chemical Romance. And even we got some comments about, like, that, you know, like, oh, someone was like, oh, so brown. Like, if we're only supposed to, like brown artist or, no, but there was people that were even, you know, kind of, like, side-eyeing or talking shit about it. And so that's where I'm like, okay, we're, like, we're not in high school anymore. I feel like that was, like, such a thing in high school, like, calling people posers and, I did that. Okay, I'm not.
Or calling people whitewash, like, to me, it was just like, how the fuck old are you? Like, I feel like it comes from a very, like, it comes from a place of insecurity in their own identity, right? And I think that's something that happens to Latinxes a lot, particularly because, like, because Latinidad is such a shit show, we hold on to cultural identifiers like there's no tomorrow, right? Like, that's why, like, every event is Selena theme, every event is Frida theme, every event is, like, Dia de los Muertos themed, right? Like, mm-hmm. because...
Conchas and...
Or concha themed, right? Like, because Latinidad is so fickle, we hold on, like, by, you know, by dear life to, like, all these, like, cultural signifiers because we're so afraid of, like, not being authentic enough, right? That any like, you know, deviation from that is suddenly, like, you know, the most inauthentic and, you know, you're kind of breaking, like, a party line in some way. And we become, like, some sort of cultural police to each other. And it's just, like, so bizarre to me. And especially because, like, I, you know, there's a lot of things that are considered cultural, like, you know, culturally, like, untouchable that I just, like, don't gravitate towards. Like, you know, I think in my childhood, like, Selena was a big part of it, right? But, you know, as I grew into my 20s, I was, like, I don't think I've, other than, like, when I'm feeling particularly nostalgic, like, I don't really put Selena on my playlist or, like, anything, right? Mm-hmm. And so things like, I don't even like conchas, as I mentioned, and people have dragged me for. Like, I don't really like conchas.
I
and so
love things, them.
So things like that are so bizarre to me that we're holding on to these, like, to these small things as, like, the be-alls, right?
And it's interesting. Sorry to cut you off. Go ahead.
No, I was done.
I was going to say, and it's very interesting because, like, everything that you just said is on point, and it's very interesting because it's like this wave that just happened in the, like, these last, like, 5 years online. Like, maybe it's always existed, but I feel like I think because it is, like, in over the last few years, it's been, like, the topic to talk about white privilege and racism and white supremacy and cultural appropriation. It's like, and feminism, like, that is the thing now. And, like, and, like, exactly what you're saying, like, we have, like, Latinidad is fickle, so we have to hold on to, like, I am Latina. And especially those who are white or light-skinned or don't know Spanish or who don't feel, like, Latino or Latina, Latinx enough, like, even more so, like, we have to, like, wear these concha earrings and we have to, like, assert how, like, Mexican we are or whatever because, but, like, I feel like I've seen it more in, like, these last, like, few years online in particular, especially with, like, Latinx publications and, like, all of, like, these Latinx pop-up shops that are coming up that, like, I'm not trying to shit on anyone, obviously, in particular, or shit on, like, you know, people's art or what they're selling, but it is mostly, what is it? It's like shirts that say, like, I'm Latina, or shirts that say I love tacos, or, like, it's always like the same thing, you know? Like, and it's also weird because it's like, I don't know, it's very interesting. But anyway, everything you said is on point about Latinidad. And I also, before I forget, wanted to point out that actually, like, with My Chemical Romance in particular, the lead guitarist, Ray Toro, is actually Puerto Rican. So, hey. Okay. So there you, know. You go. And they're, I mean, and they're not the only, like, they're, like, and this is also, like, I know Deftones is not emo, but I love Chino Moreno because that, like, Deftones has always been, like, they're such a big band, and, like, for it to be fronted by, like, this Mexican Asian man is, like, it's, like, fucking amazing to me. And also, like, bands like Coheed and Cambria, who's, like, fronted by, like, Claudio Sanchez as well, who's also Puerto Rican. Like, there are people who have always been a part of these bands and, like, these music, and maybe we don't see them, but, like, they've existed. And not just, like, Latinx folks, but also Black folks and Asian folks who make this music too and have, like, shaped it and created it. And, you know,
yeah, like, we've covered a lot of times with the Riot Grrrl scene, right? And particularly in the way that Alice Bag advocates for an accurate depiction of its history, right? Like, it's not only, like, white people making this shit, right? It is always, there's always Black and Latinx folks and other people of color, like, and indigenous folks, like, that are active agents of cultural construction, and their erasure is just kind of part of, like, this machine trying to sell itself to the mainstream. Did you have anything else to add?
No, I didn't. Well, maybe, but I feel like we've gone on for a bit, and I don't even know. I said that this whole conversation was going to be political. I don't even think it's political. It's kind of like
cultural,
or I don't know, just talking about it. Or I guess how I said, like, sometimes we want to make things political, and like when we unpack it, it's not political at all. It's just what it is, you know? Like, I'm brown and I love My Chemical Romance, like, okay. And, you know, what does that mean? Nothing. It means I have great taste in music. Yes. So of course, we need to end on My Chemical Romance song, obviously. Could you imagine if we just ended like on some other random like song? Britney. We actually have played My Chemical Romance on here before. It was actually the first song we ever played on our first second.
What was no, the twice. First one? No, we played it.
Twice. Oh, we played the Christmas. Okay, so our very first episode, we called it the. Which again, we removed it because the audio was really bad. But it is available on Patreon if you want to, you know, listen to it. You can sign up and listen to it now. But it was called the Brown Welcome to the Brown Parade because, you know, that's our thing. We wanted to establish early on that we are My Chemical Romance fans. And again, we removed that episode, so maybe people might not know that. So that was the first song that we played. And then we had a Christmas episode, I think 2 years ago, and we played My Chemical Romance cover of All I Want for Christmas Is You by Mariah Carey, which is like amazing because it's like both of our favorite like artists like in one mashup. And anyway, so I guess this will be the third time that we play My Chemical Romance on here. And we both obviously have favorite songs by My Chemical Romance. We couldn't, you know, just narrow it down to one. But
so we're playing the entire Welcome to the Black Parade album starting now.
Yes, but and if you know, if you're not a My Chemical Romance fan, and you probably, I don't know, I feel like if someone doesn't care about MCR, they probably just stop listening. Or maybe you're still listening, but you've never really cared for My Chemical Romance, or like, yeah, I heard one song, but whatever. Maybe, you know, we encourage you to like listen to it or look up their music videos and like familiarize yourself with them. You don't have to, obviously, it's not for everybody, but I feel that you would really like them. And there is still time to be a My Chemical Romance stan if you're not already. But on that note, we have decided to end on one of our favorite songs off the Black Parade, which is Famous Last Words. Which I was telling Ruben, I think that's one of my favorite songs by My Chemical Romance. I think that's one of like just one of their best songs in general. The video is like amazing because it's like a kind of like a, so I said that the Black Parade's like a concept album, right? So you kind of have to go through like, you know, in the order of the songs or whatever. But in the video of the Black Parade, if you haven't seen it, it's a literal Black Parade, right? There's a parade happening. And in the Famous Last Words video, it's like they're burning it all down. So anyway, just the visuals of it is amazing. It's amazing as a last song to that album, which again talks about like loss and death. And it, and I feel like everyone can relate to it. It doesn't have to be like you lost someone, like someone died that was close to you. It could just be, you know, like you're going through a breakup, or you're just losing a part of yourself. Like,
yeah, it's about like loss, not so much like death, like explicitly always, like explicitly maybe, yes, especially on songs like Mama,
and Cancer.
Yeah, like those are those obviously, like, it's death is explicitly called, but like, you know, if you're familiar with tarot readings, tarot cards, like, you know that death usually means like an end to things. Right? So it's mostly about like the end of things or loss and despair that comes with that as well, right? And so to your point, yeah, like it's masterful that they ended it with Famous Last Words, which is a song about hope, right? And about like, you know, wanting so desperately to live despite all this loss and death and things that end and despair. Like, it is really, it was brilliant.
It is. Yeah, I was actually listening to that earlier because I was preparing for this episode. I was like, let me see what song I want to play. And then I was like, I was literally in my car, like, about to cry because that's how emotional I get when I listen to certain songs. But it is, like, I do feel, you know, you go through this whole album and you are in your feelings about loss, about death, about whatever, like, these dark feelings. And then the end of the song, Famous Last Words, is like, I'm not afraid to keep on living. And it's like, so powerful after you went through, like, all these songs about fucking, like... dying or like losing something and like trauma, and like for the last song to still be like this proclamation of like wanting to go on and saying that you're gonna go on, I think is like very powerful. And also, you know, we're in November. I feel like it's always like a chapter when we're going towards the end of the year and reflecting on the year and what we want to do going forward. And I know people are like, you can do that whenever, time is a social, you know, all that stuff, but it's still, you know,
a colonizer construct.
Exactly. You know, yeah, tomorrow could be a new year for me, whatever, but you know what the fuck I mean. So for me, you know, towards the end of the year, I always reflect on what did I learn this year, what fucked up things. And this year has been really heavy for me, and I do, you know, like for me, it is kind of like, despite all of this shit going on, like, I'm still here, still, you know, despite like capitalism and racism and heartbreak or loss or whatever, like, we're still here. So this is why we chose this song.
Yeah, we're still here. And with that note, we are gonna end. Yeah, follow us everywhere. Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, Bitter Brown Fams. Support us on Patreon, patreon.com/bitterbrownfams. Book us for the spring, bitches.
Please book us, because if My Chemical Romance tours, we need to go. That's it. Please book us so we can go.
Especially if your city is hosting My Chemical Romance, like, book us for earlier in that day.
On that day, like, you need to book us on that day.
Yeah, in the morning, so we can just walk there in the evening. And you can do that, yes, well, for live recordings or like lectures on, like, you know, on rape culture and masculinities and rethinking Chicanismo and other topics. You can feel free to visit us at bitterbrownfemspodcast.com/bookings or emailing us at bookings@bitterbrownfemspodcast.com. So, yeah.
So, with that, we are out.
Take care, y'all.
Take care. Go listen to My Chemical Romance. All right, bye. Awake and unafraid. Asleep or dead, 'cause I'm